Hey, before we dive in, I want to connect with you on something. You know, hiring is challenging, especially with everything else that you have to consider today. I mean, today, right now, I'm recording this as there's a massive snowstorm happening in Nashville. People are freaking out. I'm talking about maybe 3 inches of snow on the ground, and people are freaking out, and you might need to hire someone to shovel your driveway. And while I'm not sure that ZipRecruiter is the platform for that, it might be, I don't know. But if you do need to hire someone for your company, for your business, for your job, ZipRecruiter is an amazing place to get this done. Let me explain a couple things. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people who have the right experience for you. ZipRecruiter makes hiring effective and efficient, and 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So if you're going to try out ZipRecruiter, which I highly recommend, you got to do this. You got to go to ZipRecruiter.com/Zach. That's my name, Z-A-K. Make sure you spell it correctly. ZipRecruiter.com/Zach. Okay, I'm done talking. Here we go. Let's dive in.
The Zach Kuhn Show.
Episode 52, Martha Earls. She is the longtime manager of country superstar Kane Brown. Prior to that, she had careers at Warner Chappell, BMG, and she also created the publishing company that would eventually become Big Machine Music. You know, what I love about Martha is that I get the vibe that she really goes with the flow. For example, with her first publishing company, her co-partner didn't think they raised enough money, and Martha's response was, it'll be fine. And you know what? It was fine. And I think that's a parallel throughout Martha's career. She doesn't get stressed out by things that I think other people might find really stressful. That might be her superpower. I don't know. You listen, you tell me what you think. Here we go. Episode 52, Martha Earls. Let's dive in. I feel like this is perfect because the Super Bowl was yesterday. The Weeknd played the halftime show, obviously, and you were kind of early on with the Weeknd's team a little bit with Jay Frank, right? Like, didn't he kind of early on discover him? What's the story there?
Jay did. Yeah, no, Jay did for sure. You know, honestly, I wish I could say that I was a part of that with him, but I wasn't. But I did get to observe it, right? And that was a gift. I mean, Jay, early days of me working with him, he was such a visionary. I don't know if you know anything about him at all.
The reading and recently passed away, I saw
Yeah, he did. That was a bummer. But he, you know, Jay's gift was to peek around the corner. I know that sounds really strange, but he had just this knack for knowing what was coming next and what the market needed next. And he knew back in 2015, when I first started working with him 6 years ago, he knew that, I mean, was in the streaming era. You only had Spotify and Tidal. Like, Apple Music hadn't even come out yet. Amazon obviously hadn't come out yet. And Jay realized that there would be a need for marketing to playlists. He just understood that that was going to be the next thing. And so he leaned way into it. And his first like huge thing that he broke was the major Laser record Lean On. And I mean, that thing streamed over 1 billion. It was like the first one to stream over 1 billion. And so then I believe Universal reached out to him and saw what he did on that record and said, oh my God, like, we need you to do work on the next thing. And our next priority is the Weeknd, you know? And it was that huge breakout record for album for the Weeknd that like was crazy. And Jay, I mean, honestly, the work that he and his team did just from a perspective of streaming and playlisting, it was incredible just to observe it. You know, I wasn't on that end of things with him, but man, he was so good at what he did. I mean, ultimately he sold his company. That whole marketing side of his company, he sold it to Universal and went and became the senior vice president of streaming. I mean, that was he was so good. So yeah, I wasn't a part of that, but man, I learned early on how critical it was to get in the right playlists, get your song sort of positioned properly. I think way before, you know, when most people were still looking at iTunes and the iTunes chart.
Yeah, was his strategy basically to just build relationships with curators early on? Was that always the strategy, or like, did you have any insight on how he was approaching it back then?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was part of it, but you know, I mean, the curators try to not be swayed. I think for Jay, a lot of it for him was awareness and data. Jay always had this expression, like the data doesn't lie. And so he would, he could really show like sort of the lean in, people who were adding songs to their collections, people who were skip rates, all those things that we can all look at, you know, now and like spot on track or anything like that. He would, I mean, he was doing all of that work by hand back in the day, just to sort of show like, hey, this is why this record has like a certain stickiness. Fans are loving it. People are saving it to their collections. They're not skipping it on playlists. You need to move it up on the playlist, you know, because position on a playlist is almost as important as being on the playlist itself. And I think he understood all of those things probably long before anybody else was even considering it.
I was going to say in 2015, he must have been like, he was a pioneer. I mean, nobody was talking about that.
Like, that's what's so crazy is he was literally the only one. That's why Lucian, you know, he was in Nashville and Lucian tracked him down and said, I don't know what you're doing, but you're not going to do it for anybody else.
And he had always dreamed of working at a label, right? Wasn't that his whole thing?
Yeah, he had. I mean, you know, Jay had such an interesting, I mean, he was a DJ. He DJed like people's graduation parties and stuff when he was like in junior high school and always was kind of hustling but always was on the front end of things. You know, he worked for Yahoo Music early on and he was just always a pioneer. But yeah, I think he always dreamed of working for a label and he, you know, he got cancer and that's how he died. He died young. I mean, he was in his 40s. And, you know, when I talked to him shortly before his death and I asked him, you know, kind of like not to get dark, but like how he felt about things and whatever. And he was just like, there's so much more I want to do. You know, he was working up, he loved working. He loved it. So, yeah.
Wow. Holy cow. Smart.
Yeah. At least he got to fulfill his dream. I mean, he built a company and sold it to a label and traveled the world and the whole thing. So
be more like Jay in life. Look ahead.
Amen to that.
Get ahead of the curve. Good stuff.
Gosh, so, yeah.
So what's the story about? I want to hear the story about how you funded your first company. Because what's the deal with there's a receptionist at BMG, right? That gets against all odds, yeah, gets funding for your
car dealer.
What's the story here?
Man, it's kind of funny. So we I was working for BMG Publishing and my longtime close friend Mike Molinar was working at an independent publisher. And he and I had talked forever about starting our own company, you know, and things were, because you know the music business kind of cratered when 2007 maybe, you know, and but it kind of hit Nashville a little late. And so for us, we were like, man, we've made so much money and have had so much success for all these other big companies that we work for, like, let's go do it on our own. How hard could it be? And so we went out and met with like a bunch of business managers, because obviously to start a company you need money. And everybody was kind of like,
What did you think you needed money for? Like an office or, I mean,
like, and I mean, overhead, like an office, but also we wanted to do publishing. And so that is signing songwriters, paying their draws, you know, paying for them to go into the studio and work, like all those things, you know? And so we went and met with all these business managers and everybody's really nice, but nobody could like get us the money. They were like, we don't know. The music business is kind of starting to do this. And then this one business manager we met with, he said to us, it was the craziest thing. He's like, you know where you're going to get your money? And we're like, no, where? And he's like, your secretary's uncle's friend. And I was like, secretary, people still say that? It's literally like what I'm thinking, right? But I was like, oh, sure, man. I swear to God, I leave the office, leave his office, go back to my office. And our receptionist, and I was kind of mad, like, wow, that guy just was like so rude. Our receptionist that was working there it was like a Friday. It was January. It was cold. It was already dark. And I was like, hey, Whitney, you want to go get a beer? And she is from Pennsylvania, which is where I'm from. And she's like, yeah, okay. And so we go get a beer. And I don't know why, but I just told her, like, hey, I want to start a company. I'm trying to find somebody to fund it, which I shouldn't have told her any of that. Cause right. Like we were working at a corporation together.
Yeah, right.
And she was like, I know somebody. And I was like, wait, what? And she was like, yeah, I know somebody. And that guy ended up, it was a friend of hers from college, that guy's his dad. And he ended up being our first investor in our company.
What did you pitch him? Like, what did you say to him? What was
the funny thing. I had never, like, I was a music business major, so I'd never really, like, in retrospect, it was perhaps a little crude what we pitched. Let's say a little lacking the basics of a business plan proposal. I don't know. I had some spreadsheets with some numbers and things and all whatever.
What do you think he bought into? Did he buy into you guys?
Totally. I mean, literally, we sat there. We were at the... we went to like the hotel of all places, the hotel bar at the Marriott. And he just looked at us and he goes, I don't know what we're doing, but let's do it.
Now, in hindsight, did he give you a lot of money relative to starting a publishing company? Was it, looking back, was it a little bit of money? It was a ton of money.
I mean, that was the thing that Mike Molinar was like a week before we were going to sign the deal, make it all official. He called me and he goes, we didn't ask for enough money. We didn't know. And he was kind of like trying to throw up all the red flags and like, cause he's the cautious one. And for me, I'm always like, I was like, it'll be fine. What are you talking about? This is going to be great. And, you know, it ultimately ended up being fine. And he, you know, our investor ended up a few years later. I mean, he was a great guy, but we ended up parting ways and it was all fine. And he ended up buying back out part of the companies. And so he was a larger owner of it. And we, you know, Molinar and I were able to use that opportunity to go and start the 2.0. So it all worked out. It was just, it was a little non-traditional.
So, okay, wait. So you get the funding and then the first thing you have to do is you have to go out and sign songwriters.
That's right.
And how, like, I always feel like for a new company, I mean, you'd been in publishing, you'd been at Warner, you'd been at BMG.
Sure.
But you're taking on a songwriter's career in your hands. Like, there's a lot of pressure there. This is your first time doing it on your own. Did you feel that pressure? How was it easy to convince songwriters to sign on?
You know, it's never easy, but to get quality songwriters. But it was, we were able to convince the songwriters that we wanted to sign because they were, they believed in, we just had this like really optimistic sort of enthusiasm, you know, and so the songwriters were excited to come on board with us. I think we felt fresh. It felt exciting. It felt like we were doing something a little bit unique. And so that wasn't so challenging, but the hard thing about publishing, and it's the reason I'm not in publishing anymore, I just don't have the stomach for it. Molinar is still in it. So you sign a writer, you're all excited, you do the photo, you're ready to go. And then you wait and you wait for them to write a song. And then you wait for them to do a proper recording of the song. And then you wait to show it to people. And then you wait to get feedback. And then if they like it, you wait to hear if they really want to record it. And then you wait for them to record it. Wait for the, I mean, it's just like, to someone who's action oriented like me, where it's like, I like to do something and results driven rather, and action oriented, do something and see a result. It was like, oh my gosh, this is killing me. You know, because you just have to wait because you're building. I mean, it's like you've planted the seeds and then you just walk out and stare at your dirt. You know,
like when in a song is the moment when they write it, is the moment when they cut it, is the moment when it's climbing up the charts, when you listen on your headphones. With an artist, the moment is when they play live. The moment is when they're doing a board show, when album drops that day, that's a moment. There's less like when's the moment of a song? When's the moment? It's harder.
That's a good question. I think it's when it, I mean, obviously like if a song's a big hit on the radio, that's great because for the publisher, there's a financial benefit. But I think it's when it finds its right home and people hear it and react to it, you know? So it's like we got a Blake Shelton cut, I remember. And we went to the show and he hadn't released the album yet, but he played it in the set. And just to see people react to Blake Shelton singing the song, it made it all like very real, you know? Yeah, I mean, once it's out and released and available for people to hear, I think is the moment. But it is, the hard thing is there's so many songs that you fall in love with that never get recorded, you know? That's the challenge.
That's the truth.
I don't have the endurance for it.
The publishing world is crazy. Did your friends and like, did your peers looking in, like, did they think that you guys were crazy trying to start this own company? Do you think they were a little envious that you were having some success early on with it? Like, were they supportive? Like, what was that like?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't, you know, when you're in it, you're not, I don't know that I was as aware, you know, as maybe I would be now. I think that everybody was excited for us to start something. I think that we, Molinar and I, had a good energy around us. So that was contagious. But I also think people know how hard it is. And so I think, you know, there's so many independent publishers in Nashville. I think that everybody realized like, wow, okay, these, you know, you guys are now jumping into this deep end of this swimming pool with us. You know, I think, you know, Nashville is a town that does root for each other, you know? And so I did feel a lot of support when we started the company, but man, it's just hard.
Not easy going into the publishing business.
No.
Unbelievable. Okay, wait. So let's go back for 1 minute. So they say that, you know, if you have a musical background, that makes you good for the business. You can connect with an artist or you can understand the creative process. You got a full ride scholarship for piano. You studied pipe organ. Does any of this help you today musically? When you go into the studio, when you're listening to a mix, when you're a live show, you're seeing performers with Kane, anything. Does any of that help you today? Do you still play ever? I'm curious.
I don't. So, you know, if you need a session player pipe organist, I am not your person. No, you know, I do think it helps you. I think that having a musical background, you just speak a language. That's what it is. I mean, it's not, you don't have to have a musical background to be successful in the music industry, but I think it does. It did help me, you know, it helps me feel confident to talk about musical things. You know what I mean? Like it helped me from a very young age working in the music industry to be able to talk or critique songwriters or give advice or give opinions or whatever. You know, because people are very, it's an opinion driven business, right? But I think that when you can speak the musical language, I think that that definitely helps.
And you transferred to Belmont, right? So I mean, you
MTSU.
Or MTSU, I'm sorry. So you were never really into the organ thing, wasn't it? I've heard you say that
it was awful. Thought
organ players just made a lot of money and didn't work very hard.
Dude, they work 2 days a week, Wednesday and Sundays. It's the greatest hustle ever.
It's the greatest. More people should be organ players. So
I definitely.
But you must have been good. You must have spent a lot of time practicing. I mean, you had a full ride, right?
I did. I was really good at the piano. Like, I was really good at the piano. And then when I showed up, you had to declare a major. And I was like, what could I make money at? That was when I declared the pipe organ. And this might come as a shock to you. That's not a very popular major. So they welcomed me with open arms. And I was 17 when I went to college. So I literally like looked around. I had like I had a moment and I was like, what am I doing? I gotta go. After like one semester. And so after that first semester, I was like, all right. And I planned my escape and I moved down here. And honestly, when I moved down here to go to MTSU, I just had you sometimes just have a feeling about something. And I was just like, man, this town feels right to me. And I have, I've never considered anything else. It's been the best. It's the best choice decision I ever made, hands down.
It's weird. This town does have that feeling for some people. I grew up in New York City. I've lived in LA. This is the best town. It pulls you in.
It is. It really is.
I don't know what it is. So, okay. So I don't want to jump around too much, but there's stuff I want to talk about. So you create your company, you sell it to BMG. You're at BMG for, Big Machine for a year.
And then you go over to Sandbox. And I've heard you say that you were really interested in Sandbox, or you were glad to spend time there, because I think you've said Sandbox's strategy is very marketing and PR focused. Yes. I'm curious, like what does that mean? I mean, I always think that artists on Sandbox have incredible brands and are very visual.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, how do you describe your management style compared to maybe like a company like Sandbox?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, you're absolutely right. That was really, you know, it's interesting. So when I was at Big Machine, so Molinar and I transitioned the company into Big Machine. Molinar knew he wanted to stay in publishing for sure. And I knew one of the songwriters we had signed was also an artist who had signed to Republic. And so I just sort of became the de facto manager, as a lot of publishers do, you know, Carrie Edwards, Ash Bow. I mean, there's a bunch of people that have followed this sort of path. And so I became this artist manager, and I realized like within 3 weeks, oh my God, like I had been doing publishing in some capacity, you know, for almost 10 years. And literally within 3 weeks, I was like, this is so much better for me. I am so much happier. And so, you know, I always knew I wanted to do once I got a taste of that, I knew I didn't want to get away with it. But the experience, because I think the Big Machine perspective is important to the Sandbox perspective. So going over and being a Big Machine to transition the company for a year while doing management, but also Scott was so inclusive. And even though I was just basically like a consultant, I wasn't an employee or anything, he invited me to every work company retreat and every meeting and every discussion. And I really appreciated that. And that was really helpful. And I learned a lot there as well, but definitely at that time, and it's probably changed a bit with the times maybe, but at that time, the number one thing was radio, country radio for them. And it was a Big Machine, and they are brilliant at country radio, and their relationships there are so strong. And I witnessed it firsthand. And so it was like, everything was led by country radio. Whatever your success is on country radio will ultimately define your success as an artist in the format. And so then when I went to Sandbox, it was the opposite. Like I started working there, I don't know, maybe I feel like it was like the beginning of February or March. And they were releasing the first Kacey Musgraves album. And I was like fascinated, going, wait a minute, they don't care about radio. You know, like they don't care about, wait, what? Well, how are they going to do this? And so then observing how they, you know, utilize media exposure, and Jason's, you know, history was in marketing, but then also understanding just like, as you said, the artist brand, where it's like every question came back to, yes, but is this on brand for the artist? And that was definitely the most valuable thing that I walked out of there with. And it was really, so now in our company now, I would say brand is critical, absolutely critical. Like, because then you're going to, if you follow the artist brand, which basically just means who they are authentically, then you will never go astray and make a decision that confuses the fans or inflames the artist or whatever. But that said, you can't just survive on that alone, right? The commerciality piece that I learned at Big Machine, right? Merging those two together, I think that's how you have a superstar, right? Because you have brand and credibility, media attention over here, but then you have to reach critical mass in terms of exposure. Otherwise, you can be all the cool in the world, but if nobody hears it, nobody hears it.
Everything. Do you think that, like, when you're thinking about an artist's brand, I mean, Kane Brown definitely has a visual and also kind of like a visceral feeling to him. Do you create like brand boards? Is it just something that you keep in your mind? Do you do like a Pinterest board around a new album cycle? How do you keep the brand in your head, or how do you know if something's going to work with the brand or not?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, Kane is such a strong personality. Like, it's interesting when I don't know if you've ever met him, but when you meet him in person, he's very, he's not like over the top, you know, he's
very
not like
mellow.
Yeah. Very low key. Like his, he's a, like early on in my career, I worked with John Rich. I don't know if you know John. And John was like marching band. We're here, you know, or whatever, riding in on an elephant. And that's just who he is, right? And Kane's sort of the opposite of that, but he has a presence to him and he has a charisma to him that is, you know, he just oozes it. And so from the first time that I met him, like, it's like, all right, I know exactly who you are. And he's great about telling me when something doesn't feel right. He behaves completely instinctually, as do I, right? Like, we don't sit around and like overthink things and second guess things and go, oh, remember when we did that such and such back in 2018, why did we do that? Like, we never do that kind of stuff. It's like he and I both act definitely out of instinct. So Kane's a super fast decision maker because he knows who he is and he is authentic. And so whenever we're embarking on anything, I mean, I just kind of innately know what he would or wouldn't do. And we've had places where it's like we've had to establish the parameters and the boundaries. But Kane is so much his own person that it's easy, right? There's no guesswork to it, you know? Whereas like, you know, there's other artists that I've been around or that I've worked with who maybe struggled with that a little bit because their brand was just kind of like boring guy, you know? So then you're trying to make boring guy interesting.
Because I think like some managers will credit themselves on establishing the brand. But for you, is it like more of the artist has to come with the brand kind of already defined? Yeah. Or is that something
that is the most critical thing? There has to be something interesting about the compelling about the person. Otherwise, I think that you just eventually you run into a brick wall. You know, you can one song you release isn't a hit, all of a sudden you've run into a brick wall and it's over. Whereas if you're an artist that you know definitively what her or his or their brand is, you always can fall back on that. You know, I look at like Eric Church, right? Nobody knows how many number ones Eric Church has or hasn't had at country radio, but they know he can sell out a football stadium.
Right, he's amazing. Mm-hmm. So something interesting about Kane's brand, which I always think is for as cutting edge musically as he is, where he always sounds very current and very hip, he often will keep a fiddle in his music, or even when he played CMT, yeah, he always has a fiddle in there. Like, is that a conscious decision, or is that just like, hey, I like the fiddle. That's part of my brand. The fiddle goes in.
Yeah. And that was his decision, honestly, because we, when he was writing the Experiment album, like a couple of the songs definitely had that, like, there's a song called Short Skirt Weather that had this like Alan Jackson vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was kind of that. It was that song that after they wrote it and they were like, yeah, we need to go just straight Alan Jackson fiddle with this, you know, because Kane is a country vocalist. I always say this. I say this 1,000 times. He's a country singer, but he's a cultural crossover. Right. So he's a country vocalist. So any of those sounds, fiddle, all of that is very on point for his music. And so, but yeah, it was Short Skirt Weather was the song. And it was like, let's put a fiddle on this. Let's really like go for it. So when he was making Experiment, he wanted to take this, like these edgier types of songs and even sometimes like subject matter. There's a song called American Bad Dream on that record, like subject matter, and then add in some of these more traditional sounding instruments, but overlaid over top of this like progressive tension of where he was going musically, if that makes sense. And it kind of led to this like cool little hybrid of, you
it
know,
makes it stand out in both worlds, because in the country yeah. world the music's so progressive that stands out, and if you go more on the pop or the crossover world, now it has fiddle in it, so it works both ways.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that was like, it's funny because we didn't have a fiddle player in our band until the Experiment album. And then Kane was like, we need to hire another player, somebody who plays the fiddle. And I remember I was like, really? Like, okay. And then it made such a huge impact. And now our fiddle player, like, he's a definitive part of our every show. You know, he's this like huge sort of like guy. And I think when we were in Europe last year, he was just in Amsterdam, they described him as the large man with the tiny fiddle. That's how the media called him.
That is so good. So, okay. So I'm curious because Kane was really one of like the first artists to break on social media, especially one of the first country artists.
And oh yeah.
We're kind of in like a second wave of artists breaking on social media with TikTok. And I think that a lot of artists who are breaking on TikTok are kind of getting written off, or they're like, oh yeah, that's just a TikTok thing. Or maybe for right or wrong, you know, they're kind of, there's almost like a stigma to it.
Yes.
Was that something that you had to battle early on with Kane of, oh, he's just a social media artist? And any tips for how to, you know, get rid of that stigma if you're an artist breaking today?
That's a great question because we completely encountered that. I mean, funny enough, like 6 years ago, Kane and I started working together in September of 2015. So 5.5 years ago, which is nuts that 5.5 years have passed. But it was Facebook. The platform for him was Facebook, you know, which now seems so unbelievably not cool.
Nobody's breaking on Facebook today.
Facebook's like, I can't even go on Facebook. It's like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. It's like the National Enquirer meets my high school, meets like some sort of like fake
news. Rotary phone. Like, it's just like, it's not good.
It's not good. We encountered that. I mean, we encountered that especially because of aforementioned Jay Frank, who worked with him, was, you know, known for his work in the digital space. And so people kept saying, oh, there's no way this kid on social media can be selling this much, you know, selling these many downloads or have this much popularity. This all has to be fake. Because when people don't understand something, there's frequently a huge resistance and almost a predisposition, I'd say, by a lot of the population to shoot it down, right? It's like, I don't understand that. It makes me slightly uncomfortable. I'm going to shoot it down. And that's what happened to us. But the reality is, it's just those people are late adopters and eventually they become comfortable with it. And sure enough, they come around, right? So we absolutely experienced that. I mean, there were news articles written about it. There was all of this kind of stuff. And so what I always told Kane is, I said, okay, well, here's the thing. Like, anybody can click like on a Facebook video, right? All right, then what's the next step? The next step is, okay, I put a new track up. Anybody can stream that track. But you have to ask yourself, are they going to leave Facebook and go stream that track or download that track or however it was at the time? Are they going to go do that? Okay, that's the first step. Then the next step is we started to put shows on sale just to see what would happen. You know, we were going to woodshed for Kane. What's the name of the place? Oh, I'm trying to remember it. It's in like South Carolina, Darlington, South Carolina. Our guitar player at the time had a line on like a club down there that was like a 750 capacity room. And I was like, hey, you guys got to start doing some shows because you've never really done shows. And Florida Georgia Line invited you on their tour.
That's different. Like when I talk to TikTok artists today, not going to name any names.
Yeah.
Some of them go, oh yeah, we don't even need to play shows. Like we're getting but that's ridiculous, right? You have to
get ridiculous. And here's why. So you think about it. So, okay. So you say, so for Kane, it was like, all right, you're going to go out on tour with Florida Georgia Line. You got to be ready. You got to be able to play shows. And so we put Darlington on sale. But he was so popular on social media that the show sold out in like 30 minutes. And so then the club owner was like, can I do a second show? We're like, I guess so. So he put a second one on it, sold out in 15 minutes. So those are the steps, right? Are people willing to watch your video? Are they willing to like and share your video? Are they willing to then go stream your music? And then are they willing to come out from behind their computer and actually go to a show? And so I think with like TikTok right now, we're in such a weird time because it's the pandemic.
Right.
And so you can't go play shows. I mean, you maybe you can on a small scale here and there, but not like traditionally you would. And so we don't know yet if people can go through all of those steps that it takes to become successful. I mean, I think the other difference is TikTok is a bit of a different animal with the algorithm, right? Where it's not a, like if you think about Facebook or Instagram or whatever, like I curate my own Instagram, right? Like whoever I want to look at is who I look at.
You don't
on TikTok though.
Your TikTok, or you do, but you don't.
Yeah, but you don't really, because TikTok opens on on, it's the way it opens, right? It's just how it opens, and it just opens with random videos. And then we're all so inherently lazy that we don't scroll over to who we're following. We just watch those videos, you know, or whatever. And so, yeah, eventually it kind of starts sort of shaping like what you may or may not be interested in, but we don't have a lot of control over that. So it is different in that I think TikTok is really useful in breaking songs. Can you break whole complete artists off of it solely? I don't know. I think
if you're an artist who had a song blow up on TikTok, and obviously you want to become a household name as an artist, sure. You don't want the song to be bigger than you. Is the key that you have to start putting out content on other platforms? Top of funnel, you pull them in through TikTok, and then where can you send them from TikTok? Like, how do you create that relationship, do you think? I mean, I guess nobody knows right now with TikTok.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what you have to do, is I think that you have to take it from people who are sort of getting your content fed to them, to people, it's an additional layer, right? To people choosing to want to look at what you're doing every single day, you know, on other platforms, and then to them sharing your content, defining their own brand by your brand, and then leaning into the music. Now, I think with TikTok, what's interesting is that these songs break because people obviously not only like the videos, but they also use the songs, right? So that's like a little bit of a different, it's a different twist, right? That didn't exist with Instagram or Facebook, where they're actually able to go do an action with your song. But the artist has to have more value than just that one song. And a lot of that, I think, is the team that's around the artist, you know, where it's like, okay, you have a choice. After you have one big hit, you have a choice, and you can choose to do all the work and evolve into a well-rounded, successful artist and entertainer, or you can be somebody who's really successful on one platform, but you have to know that that's much more fleeting. That will eventually go away.
What do you think, like, what's one small step if your song blows up on TikTok, blows up, let's say, is your next step, hey, get a music video up on YouTube? Is it, hey, you know, tell people to buy my merch? Like what's a small thing to do that sort of pulls it away from TikTok and maybe can establish you as, hey, I'm a real artist. I'm not just a TikTok artist.
Yeah. I mean, well, what I would do is, if you don't want to be defined by one song, then have more than one song available. You know, if you have a song, I mean, it seems so common sense, right? But if you have a song that blows up on TikTok, well, go ahead and release that song, have music ready to go. That's always my advice, is have music ready to go, because that does happen. Side note, that does happen to artists where they put a song up, it blows up on TikTok, and they don't have it ready to go. And then it gets
scrambled and
move on. Yeah. Right. And they're left behind. You have to be ready to go. And so so maybe put up two songs, maybe put up a two pack, maybe put up an EP, like let people know who you are. And then also, you're right, pull them over to YouTube, have them watch a video, see, you know, if there's some of these songs are gaining popularity on platforms like The Highway and, you know, satellite radio or whatever, double down on those, you know, anywhere that you feel people are showing interest, double down in those places. I mean, and then again, you're right, like get people to other platforms, even if it's just coming over to Instagram, even if it's just recreating what you're doing on TikTok on Reels, go do it, because then that will boost your Instagram following.
Right. Why do you think, and I've heard you say many times that like the Kane Brown effect is purely that he just has that star quality or that, you know, persona, or it's so hard to describe. But it is kind of insane that, like, I think there's a lot of people who connect on social media who probably couldn't pull 700 people per show, two nights sold out the first time out of the gate. No. I mean, anything describable about how that happened, or like, was there anything he was doing that just really connected, or is it purely something that, you know, is unexplainable?
Well, you have to think, he put the work in. So that show in Darlington was on, I'll never forget, it was like November 13th, 2015. And so he had put the work in. I mean, even before I was involved, he was putting the work in on social media, posting, doing, and he would do a mixture of covers and originals so that fans, he would sing a song that they felt comfortable with. And then he would sing a new song and get them comfortable with the idea of him singing some, it, you know, presenting something they had never heard before, right? And so he balanced that really well. And he also let a lot of his personality come through. So by the time we got around to, even though it felt like overnight, by the time he got around to Darlington, I mean, he put in a year of straight hard work on social media. And so the fans felt like they knew him. And I think that's part of it. And then I also think for the fans, they just wanted to see if it was, if he was really there, you know, cause they had been following him for a year. So I think that's the other thing that's challenging is like Kane had a, I mean, I'm trying to think before Darlington, he had multiple videos with 20, 30 million views on them, you know? So it wasn't like he popped a hit and then immediately rushed out and sold tickets or something, or got popular on social media and immediately rushed out and sold tickets. I mean, he did the work, he put in the time. And that's the thing too, is I feel like with TikTok things, the pace is so accelerated that, you know, cause the labels want to like snatch up those artists so quickly that, that it doesn't give them the opportunity to sort of build the fan base in some semblance of permanence.
Yeah, absolutely. Was international part of the plan early on? Like Kane's one of the few country artists who really made it a point to go international and go into Europe and play Australia, right? Was that always part of the strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like with Kane, I mean, our first goal with Kane was just getting country radio to accept and play him, which was challenging at first. And then after that, I think it became, when we went international, like we started to feel that there was like a strong pull for us to go overseas or for Kane to try features with artists who maybe had large ex-US, you know, followings and whatnot. And I think it's a lot of it is because his image is very approachable outside the country format. You know, I mean, what is within the country format, like completely non-traditional and kind of scary to like, oh my gosh, like here's this guy with tattoos and he's biracial and you know, this and that. Outside of country, it's like, oh, thank God, here's somebody that doesn't have a cowboy hat and a belt buckle and is like riding a horse, right. You know?
Yeah.
You know? So I think his image absolutely made the pull for international much stronger. And then now since we've done, I mean, the song with Marshmello was huge on an international level. This hit that we just had with Swae Lee and Khalid was really big on an international level. Like there's such a pull for us to go back that, you know, I don't think, unfortunately, because of Corona, I don't think it's going to happen until 22, but we definitely want to get back. And Australia is a priority. We've never been to Australia, but what's crazy is if you go on Kane's Spotify for Artists, two of his top 10 cities are in Australia.
Crazy. And you guys were actually offered to play with CMC. I always, CMC is the Australian festival, right? Mm-hmm. And you guys turned it down because you wanted to break the market in your own way. If I have this correct, am I right about this?
Yeah. I mean, sort of, I don't, you know, it was a timing issue, if I remember correctly as well, because we would have just been coming off a headlining tour. Of course, it all got upended and turned upside down. But I'm not averse. I mean, here's the thing. I'm not averse to Kane doing CMC, just like I'm not sitting here going, the only way we can get into Australia is if Kane does the country festival. I don't think there's a wrong decision.
Yeah.
I think either whatever his entry point into the market is fine, as long as, you know, what my role is once he's in the market, then how do we maximize that opportunity and reach all the fans, right? If we're going in and doing a country festival, then we have an obligation to reach all the fans who maybe are fans of his non-country hits, right? Or if we went in and did strictly non-country, like, oh no, we're not doing that. Well, we don't want to leave behind all the country fans because he has a huge country following too. So it's like trying to figure out how to super serve sort of all the different parts of the fan base.
Is it mind-boggling to you that more artists don't go overseas, or do you kind of get it? Or, you know, like if a manager of an A-list artist came to you and said, hey, we've never been overseas, but we really want to go, we're thinking about it. What would you tell them? Would you push them to try it? Or would you say maybe there's a reason the artist doesn't have to go?
I mean, I would absolutely encourage people to go, if not for anything but the experience. Like the experience of your artist, you know, all the guys with the exception of like one of our band guys and like two of our crew guys, for the vast majority of them, they had never been, like they considered Niagara Falls an international date. You know what I mean? They had never been anywhere. And so just for them to have that experience, and it was a gift, I'll be honest, that we had that. It was exactly this time last year. We were in Berlin, I think maybe we were either flying back or we were in Berlin this date last year. And
I was actually on the road in Europe this year, and we actually had a passing press date at the BBC.
No way.
Where I think I was going with my artist and Kane was like coming out. It was like,
that's crazy.
Yes.
In London?
In London, yes. We were with Luke Roberts with Lime Tree Music, which I think is who you guys were using also.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Yes.
So funny. Yeah, it was a gift being able to do that. You know, that was kind of like the last hurrah right before the pandemic hit. I mean, that was like...
Yeah, same here. That was like, I was overseas for a month and then we came back and it was all shut down.
And then you were in your house for a year. Yeah, I mean, so I think for that reason, culturally, I mean, I'm a big fan of like sort of expanding cultural, you know, opening your mind, seeing what's out there, exposing your artists and your band and your crew to the world, I think is really culturally important. You know, the reason more don't do it is it's not cheap. It's not cheap to go over there and to take everything over there and put your show on. And, you know, it's not like it's a huge, like those first couple of trips aren't huge money earners. And so the hard thing is like, you have to sort of swallow the pain pill of going, we're going to go over there and it's not going to be highly lucrative, but it pays dividends to set us up for the future.
Absolutely. Is it, I feel like it would be so fun to put together like an arena show or just like design the set, or, you know, are we going to do a catwalk or no catwalk? What are we going to do this time? Like, how do you put that together? Do you hire a company or a team to do that? How does the show itself, like the physical part of it, how does that come together?
You know, it's funny because we're actually thinking about this for, God willing, the fall, please. we're thinking about this right now. You know, so what we do, like the first step is, you know, we route the tour. Right. Because you can't plan something if you don't know where you're doing it.
Right.
So because like an amphitheater show is going to be dramatically different than an indoor arena show. So we route the tour, and then our production manager, our tour manager, myself, usually it's the three of us, sit down with Kane, sometimes some other people from my team, our creative director is always, he's always there. And we're like, all right, what are you thinking? You know, and that's like a big question to ask somebody. So it's kind of overwhelming, I think, to Kane sometimes. And then it's like, all right, now let's boil it down. Like, do you want exactly the questions you're asking? Do you want a catwalk? Yeah, always yes. A thrust, as we call it. Do you want a thrust? Always yes. Do you want a pit? Yes, but small, right? Do you, you know, what did you like about last year? Oh, I liked this, this, and this, but I didn't like this, you know, or whatever. And we start kind of, you know, shaping it slightly. And then we work with a set designer and our creative director, and they sort of come up with some renderings, and we'll show Kane, like usually we'll get like three or four different options and show them to Kane, and he'll decide what is in the direction that he wants. And then we'll settle on one, and then we'll start really getting in there and like whittling it down so that we know exactly what we want it to be. But I mean, our tour, we only did 5 dates of it at the beginning of the year. I mean, it was crazy. He did a drop. Kane like climbed to the top. He was like 4 stories in the air and had a harness and did a drop onto the stage. And it was
like
it was absolutely nuts.
Oh my God. That seems like such a fun element or fun part of the job is putting that together. And then you see it live. Are you going to have to scrap all of that stuff? Or are you still going to use some of it in the fall?
No, I mean, we own a lot of those pieces and we only played 5 dates. So it's not like, you know, it doesn't feel old, but we'll definitely update it. You know, I mean, if you think about it, our show, what's so crazy is the 5 shows that we played in March, at the very beginning, end of February, beginning of March, February 29th is when we started. the musically, Kane has put out so much music that wasn't even released at that point.
Right.
That we, that our whole show has to change just to accommodate the music.
Holy cow. Okay. Fall, fingers crossed, Kane Brown coming to a city near you. I had Clarence Spaulding on this podcast, and he said he was fiercely independent until Irving Azoff called and convinced him to join Full Stop. And then he broke away. And then he said, I was never joining a management company ever again until Guy Osiri called and asked him to join Maverick. You are independent to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah.
Would you ever join a bigger company? Would you ever team up with anyone? What would it take?
I don't know. I mean, I've gotten some of those calls in the past, honestly, which I take as a huge compliment because I'm not naive to think that somebody just wants to get in business for me. Although, but I know that it's a financial thing, right? So obviously somebody's looking at the business we're doing and going, hey, that's a profitable investment. Like, I want to be a part of that. So I take it as a huge compliment. I mean, you never know, but I mean, one of the beautiful things about what we're doing here at my company is that we have multiple companies. We have a production company that we started this year where we're developing an animated series right now, you know, and we're able to do things that are like, we manage a tattoo artist, you know, and we're able to do things that are a little bit avant-garde. And so I would never want to lose the ability to do that. You know, I could never let our identity get sucked up, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know. Who knows?
You never gotten tattoos together? Do you have any tattoos?
I don't have any tattoos.
I don't have any tattoos either.
A lot of commitment.
They scare the crap out of me.
Yeah. It's difficult for me to commit to like a restaurant reservation, let alone a tattoo.
I have a reoccurring nightmare throughout my life where in my nightmare, I get a tattoo and it scares the crap out of me in my nightmare. And then I wake up and I always check that part of my body to make
sure. Like, oh, thank God.
Yeah. Can't get
my face.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. But I had no idea that you guys manage a tattoo artist. Holy cow. That is so cool.
We do.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Martha, we're almost at the hour.
Yeah,
we have
done it.
What have we left out? Have we left anything out? There's an entire label that you started with Kane with something that we didn't even talk about. Signed Reckless Road, Restless Road.
We love Restless Road.
Unbelievable act. By the way, I had no idea that Kane Brown's about to make his Opry debut this weekend, right? Next weekend?
He is. Yeah, it's
How
so
possible. That's mind-blowing to me that he hasn't done it already.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I mean, that he hadn't. But what's strange is also that it's kind of anticlimactic because there was no audience. There was no one to introduce. You know, I've done Opry debuts with people and it's this whole thing and you're backstage and there's a cake and people coming by and hugging you and shaking your hand. And this was just like, we showed up and he sang the song and left, you know, because of COVID. So I don't know. We need to do it properly. I almost feel like it doesn't count because it wasn't the experience.
We need a proper Opry debut from Kane Brown. What's happening with Restless Road? Anything we can talk about?
Oh my God. We're releasing a track actually on Wednesday that we are so excited about. We put an EP out on them right before the pandemic. They were like on top of the world. We put an EP out. It goes number one. They play the Today Show. They're on tour with Kane and then crash. So we're putting out a song on Wednesday that's just an up-tempo, fun summer song that I feel like is now sort of, you know, they spent the year really doubling, working on their social media. They went from, I'm so proud of them, from zero TikTok followers. Now they have over 800,000.
Crazy.
So they grew, they'll be at a million, knock on wood, shortly, probably within a year of working on it. And so, so now it's capitalizing on that new fan base and releasing music and trying to get them out there and get them on country radio, hopefully.
When you team up with Sony for this label and Kane Brown is a partner in it, what is Sony basically saying? Is Sony basically saying, we trust your team to find great acts, A&R project, come up with good marketing, we'll provide radio support or whatever, you know, whatever it is here. But I mean, there's a huge amount of trust there when they partner up with you that to crush it basically, right?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the fact, I mean, like with Kane, you know, we are highly engaged, highly proactive. Every marketing plan, usually like we come to them first before they can even do it and say, hey guys, this is what we want to do. And so I think that, us getting this opportunity is sort of like a, I don't know, maybe it's an affirmation of the work that we've been doing.
I've heard you say that at labels, you don't just go for the top guy. You try to win everyone over.
Top to bottom. Tips
for winning over the team at a massive label?
Man, I think it's, you just have to respect what everybody does, you know, and appreciate what everybody does. Like, it's crazy. Like, you think about, there's 40 artists signed to Sony that people could give their time and attention to on any given day. And the fact that they're working on your artist is that's incredible. Right. And so I think I like to make people know that I see and appreciate and that we're working together. You know, so many people have that adversarial label relationship, and I want it to be the opposite of, especially with like people, you know, that aren't the top, that aren't the CEO, right? Of going like, I know you're just trying to do your job and I'm just trying to do your job and let's do it together. And our success is your success. And I think that, I don't know, I think some of my close friends I've gotten to know from working on the Kane Brown project with them.
So be friendly to everyone, even the receptionist, because they might fund your first company. We've brought it full circle.
It's so true.
Martha, thank you so much for taking the time. This was so much fun. I'm glad that we finally were able to make it happen.
Me too. Thank you for having me. It was so great talking about all this stuff.
Absolutely. And tell Mike hello. We were in a school together, and we were in our ear training classes together in harmony, struggling greatly together.
Oh, I just can't do that.
And apparently neither could we.
No, I don't miss any of that stuff at all, but Mike is the best. That is for sure.
He is. Stay well out there, and hopefully non-pandemic, I'll see you in person somewhere soon.
You'll have to come to a show this fall.
I would love to come to a show. I saw Kane play at South By.
Oh yeah, that was a weird little thing.
4 years ago at some weird
Budweiser thing. Hay bales.
That's the only time I've seen Kane play, and I feel like I have to see him again because I feel like it's a completely different.
No, we're going to play all the majors, New York, Boston, all the big ones. So, you know, just pick one and we'll go and it'll be a fun time.
Unbelievable. I'm excited for it. Stay well out there and hope to talk to you soon. You too.
All right. Bye.
There you have it. Episode 52, Martha Earls. Thanks for tuning in. And thanks again to Martha for taking the time to come onto the show. I love her story because it's just a story of an entrepreneur going from zero to hero. You know, she came to Nashville with not much in terms of music industry experience or background, and she has turned to a massive power player, which is just inspiring. You know, it can be done. If you put the work in and you work hard, you could be Martha Earls when you grow up. One day, I'm still hoping to be just that. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at NashvilleBriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. The Zach Kuhn Show is brought to you by ZipRecruiter and is part of the American Songwriter Podcast Network. That's it. That's a mouthful. Holy cow. We'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm out. Goodbye.